There's a law in the U.S. called the National Environment Policy Act, which essentially requires executive agencies to do environmental impact statements of how a particular development or project will affect the environment.
Welcome to Building Connections, presented by IPEX. In each episode, we delve into the world of construction, exploring how key leaders in the space shape the infrastructures of tomorrow. Discover the stories behind the solutions that impact municipal, commercial, and residential projects across North America.
Welcome to Building Connections, the podcast where we dive into the world of water and electrical infrastructure, exploring the challenges and innovations shaping the future. I'm your host, Greg Blackett, and today we have a very special guest. His name is Greg Goodwin. Greg is a senior research director at Bluefield Research. Greg has a wealth of knowledge about the North American pipe network and the critical issues impacting municipalities today. So in this episode, we're going to discuss everything from infrastructure challenges to sustainability, water quality, and we're also going to get into the recent election and how that may impact policy. So let's dive in. Welcome, Greg. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me, Greg. Great to be here.
That's great. And I'm glad you joined us. And there's a lot to talk about, so I'm really happy you joined us. But first, Greg, just talk a little bit about what you do at Bluefield, just to set some context around what we're going to talk about today.
Sure. For folks who aren't familiar with Bluefield, Bluefield Research is a market research firm that is exclusively focused on water and water management issues. We look deeply across the value chain within municipal, industrial, stormwater, into digital water. It's the only area we really cover. So we get pretty deep in terms of the kind of main issues that are affecting the sector. We engage with folks in a number of different ways. So we sell off-the-shelf reports that deal with any number of topics. We have subscription services, which are based on research verticals, whether that be municipal or industrial, where folks subscribe for a period of time. They have access to our data, to our reports, and to a dedicated analyst. And then the last way that we engage with folks typically is through dedicated custom consulting work, which is where I'm mostly focused on. So that's essentially any research area that we cover, doing a really deep custom dive for clients to answer any number of questions that are based on strategic initiatives or market sizing or entry or due diligence, anything that's related to really detailed look at the sphere itself. But on a more personal level, I have an energy and international relations policy sort of background. I've done some work in the manufacturing sector around different types of processes and technology that sort of helped me slide tangentially a little bit into this type of role. Been at Bluefield for about 6 years or so. And yeah, just really focused on helping clients understand the landscape of where things are going.
That's good. And I think, you know, it's important for everyone to understand the research you guys do is fairly specialized in the sense that there's, you know, not a lot of other, I think, third party or agencies or research houses that cover the areas that you cover in the same level of detail that you do. And so that's, you know, one of the reasons why you're here today to talk about some of those details. And, you know, the first one I think that'd be interesting to get into is to talk about the state of the North American pipe network, because it's really a critical infrastructure that is often forgotten, but you guys really understand this space. So maybe just comment, what's the current state of our North American pipe network? Are there challenges? And, you know, what are the problems facing municipalities today?
Sure. So I guess to start at the most basic level, it's not great overall in terms of kind of there's a lot of age of infrastructure and to deal with across sort of the network across the US and Canada. So I guess this is more US specific, but there's that American Society of Civil Engineers study that comes out every year that kind of uses the report card metric. And it's never a great grade that's being applied to most area infrastructure. And the pipe network is no different. There are a number of specific challenges that we can talk about a little bit. Age of infrastructure is obviously a big one. Particularly, I'm based in the Northeast in the US in Boston, particularly in the Midwest, Northeast, there's a lot of very old pipes in the ground. Some in Boston go almost back to the Civil War era. A lot of those are in dire need of updates to be replaced. So that's a large challenge across, I'd say, the country and across going into Canada as well. Some of the sort of cross-sectional challenges within that is like leakage management is a big issue as well. So there's different parts of the U.S. where there are different policies that are in place to address leakage management, whether these are mandatory audits or other types of reporting structures. It's a patchwork across the U.S. Some have it, some don't. I think the national number across the U.S. anyway is about 17% of delivered water is lost per year. So particularly as you're getting into water-stressed areas, that's a huge challenge. That's a huge amount of waste that a preventive measure could do a lot to reduce that number. There are other things that are coming down the pipe as well in terms of in the U.S., there's a large initiative to get all the lead service lines out of the ground. So this is primarily the private side of the line from the main to the dwelling or structure. There are many miles of that are still in the ground. It was only outlawed in 1986 in terms of an actual infrastructure implementation policies, particularly in the older areas of the country, the Midwest, Northeast. There's a huge legacy of that material still in the ground, and there's a lot of federal dollars that are being put behind to remove that over the next couple of decades. That's actually something I think could probably change a little bit with recent changes in electoral politics in the U.S.
So maybe let's jump in there and talk about that. So I think your characterization of the network probably isn't surprising to a lot of people, you know, an aging infrastructure. My understanding was that in the last 3 years, there's been some policy established and money set aside in the terms of the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act to address the network, to allocate funds, to improve the network. How is that going? Is the money flowing into the right places? Is it just early days right now?
Yeah, so we've been tracking that fairly closely over the past year or so. So there was supposed to be a $55 billion that was specifically appropriated by Congress for a host of water management sort of issues. The big buckets were the state revolving funds in the U.S., which are the main sort of federal coffers that federal dollars are distributed through. And then there was the $10 million specifically for PFAS, which is a micropollutant that's gotten a lot of attention the last couple of years. And then there was $15 billion that was allocated for lead service line removal. As we look at that 50-ish billion that was originally the headline number, by our count, looking across the different gates of the bureaucracy for getting that money from actual legislation into the ground, by our count, it's about $7 billion of that 50 that has reached about 1,220 project-level awards so far. So that's money that's actually gone to the subprime awardee, whether that's a specific state or a tribal agency, and is being directed towards a project. So there's about $21 billion of the 55 that's been contractually obligated. So that's money that there's supposedly a contract between the federal government and the prime award recipient. So that would typically be a state, but that hasn't been distributed so far. So that's still less than half that has been actually gone through most of the process to get to projects. And that was a law that was passed, I think, almost exactly 3 years ago today. So it does take a while to get through sort of the bureaucratic gates to find the money on the ground. But we do expect to see that kind of move forward now that the wheels have been greased a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's a positive direction. And you mentioned previously something about, you know, the recent change the coming change in the administration, Donald Trump taking the presidency. So let's jump into that. I'm really curious what you guys see from a policy change around Donald Trump presidency, whether it's, you know, changes to the infrastructure job acts. You know, we hear a lot about removing, I guess, red tape and bureaucracy to improve infrastructure projects. What are you guys seeing and what are your thoughts coming into this?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, we actually did a white paper back at the end of the summer where we laid out like contingencies of what we thought might happen if, say, White House changed hands, or the Congress changed hands, the different sort of mixed government versus trifecta sort of scenarios. So we are in a trifecta scenario in terms of control of the Congress and the White House now in the U.S. going into January. I think the things that can be said with fairly high confidence is that I think the IIJA funding is probably safe. It would take an affirmative act of Congress to really try to claw back money that had already been appropriated for that. And it's pretty broadly popular in terms of what's being felt on the ground. So I'd expect that would probably continue through in terms of the timeline that is set for that. Some things that I think might change a bit are, so there's the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed a few years back, that the Republican Party stance towards that has been negative. It goes against their philosophy around where spending should go, clean energy versus traditional forms of energy. So there's been some congressional leadership commentary around repealing that, or at least some parts of that. So there's an element of water for hydrogen that's within that bill that I think is probably at risk of being repealed within that. Another thing is around sort of policies that can be directed by executive agencies. So the lead service line removal rule in the U.S., there was a certain target that the Biden administration had for percentage per year to address and kind of the overall timeline. I think that's likely to shift to be a longer time frame and a less aggressive target for yearly removal. So that's something I'd look for going into the year in terms of how certain policies that have been enumerated so far might shift in terms of new administrative sort of imperatives. Another is around, and actually I think there's the part of this that's purely electoral now, but there's a lot that's been going on in the U.S. in the last 3 to 4 years as the makeup of the Supreme Court has changed. So there's a pretty dramatic upheaval of how the branches of government are now relating to each other. So this current iteration of the Supreme Court has more of a deregulatory philosophy. And there are some decisions that have been made in the last 2 or 3 years, particularly the last year, that are going to open up a lot of probably legal challenges to certain things that have been promulgated in the last, it actually goes quite a far ways back. But so there was a decision back in June called Loper-Bright, which basically ended a 40-year precedent of deference to executive agencies on rulemaking in cases of statutory ambiguity. So essentially now that where there were places where EPA would fill in some of the gaps on a specific law, the Supreme Court said that is no longer kind of the standard way of doing things. And so courts are now going to be more involved in deciding what those ultimate facts and figures might be for regulations. That and another law that basically, there's one called Corner Post, which deals with the Administrative Procedure Act in the U.S. Without getting too legalese here, basically it opens up challenges to laws past a 6-year statute of limitations. Essentially, I think going into next year and the future, there will be legal challenges available for certain regulatory decisions that would not have been available, say, 2 years ago in terms of how those challenges would be received by a court. There's definitely, and I think that could affect things like the PFAS-MCL in the U.S. There's some questions on how EPA formulated that specific MCL, if it was based on certain scientific methods or disputes about that, where that will now probably be open to challenge in a way that it wouldn't have been like 2 years ago. So those are some broad things that I think are worth looking at just in the face of kind of recent events.
So if I understood you, maybe put in like a practical terms, if the EPA made a decision based on a particular, call it project, I don't know if this is making sense, then, you know, the contractor or the owner could maybe challenge that decision based on the recent changes to the structure you mentioned. Is that a good way to look at it? Or?
Yeah, more or less. If the Congress made a specific law where there was some ambiguity about exactly how the specific regulation, the number applied to, say, a contaminant would be made. And until for the past 40 years, essentially, the EPA has filled in sort of those gaps. And there's been deference given to the executive agency. And so now the Supreme Court has basically said that sort of precedent of always deferring to what an executive agency says about specific numerical constraints is now overruled. And so they're basically saying that Congress has to either make that very explicitly clear. And then until that happens, that's like where a court might take over. So it does take the rug out of what has been happening the last several decades. And we'll probably have a bit of, I don't want to say anarchy, but there won't be a clear guidepost for how to deal with this for probably a little bit in terms of what the dust being settled.
Right. Okay. And then is there anything else? I mean, I hear a lot about the DOGE organization forming, and there's a lot of bureaucracy at various levels that slow down projects. You know, you talked about the EPA. There's certainly a lot of environmental requirements, and there's a whole slew of other ones. Is that a real challenge right now? And do you see any changes there?
Yeah. So I think another area that, again, this is both on the policymaking side of what the administration will probably want to do, and then how courts are approaching it. So there's a law in the U.S. called the National Environment Policy Act, which essentially requires executive agencies to do environmental impact statements of how a particular development or project sort of downstream effects within the environment. And so there are current challenges or disputes about what's the breadth of that? How deep does it have to go? How many levels? And then there are some courts that are looking into that now that will probably shift what is required under that law. So depending on kind of your perspective, whether you think that's a good thing or not, it could certainly speed up the permitting process for a lot of different projects in terms of regulations that might be necessary for certain environmental protection. Those could probably be affected adversely. It's a sort of where you stand on whether that's a good thing for your business, for where you live. It will affect both sides on different, there'll be give and take and how that plays out. But that's definitely something that I think we'd expect to shift as well. There's a lot of talk about NEPA right now.
Building Connections is brought to you by IPEX, leaders in thermoplastic piping systems, where innovation meets reliability. Elevate your infrastructure projects with our comprehensive range of products designed for durability and efficiency. Visit ipexna.com to discover how our solutions can enhance your next project today.
Let's shift gears and talk about, I mean, we talked about the Environmental Protection Agency. We talked about, you know, removing some of the, you know, the traditional burdens in terms of that are allocated to projects. If you look at the water network in general, in terms of quality and contaminants, you mentioned PFAS. Is it a problem today in the water network when you look at quality across North America, the United States?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so PFAS has gotten a lot of attention in recent years for good reason. It's one of those things that, like, every time there's a new headline about it, it expands more, right? The number of compounds that go under the PFAS umbrella is bigger. The number of areas where it's been found increases. That has gotten enough, I think, public attention, both at the local and state and federal level, that is going to need to be addressed regardless. Whether it becomes more of a decentralized approach based on how the federal government is, you know, approaching regulation or how courts interpret that, it is open to question. But that's definitely something that we see a lot of investment in on all levels, from the treatment providers to the lab space to testing. It's a very pervasive problem in the U.S. There are specific areas that have like either an industrial or military-based legacy where it's a very concentrated problem. So like Michigan is an area like that, New York, New Jersey, where you see pockets of high concentration, and those states took the lead in terms of how those policies are implemented. So I think that will continue to be probably a high-level challenge, get a lot of sort of mind share across the industry for the next foreseeable amount of time. I think it's one of the things that we're seeing with PFAS, though, is it's pretty well understood what the way to deal with it on the drinking water side is. It's typically a combination of granulated activated carbon, ion exchange resin, or reverse osmosis that are applied to some of these systems. The bigger question is what's going to happen on the wastewater side when this ends up either in landfills or in biosolid content that's applied to like agricultural or sort of land spreading applications. There's an open question in the US of how that's going to be dealt with. And I think a lot of the investment, a lot of the research is on that side of the utility now, because that's the end stage of what happens to the compounds before they get back into the water table. But yeah, it's definitely going to be a big area of concern going forward for probably several decades. We sometimes call it the new DDT at Bluefield in terms of the scope of the problem.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you mentioned in the beginning, you're talking about stormwater a little bit. I think you mentioned it. And so let's maybe talk about that, because, you know, that's, I think, effectively what you're saying is, how do you manage, you know, runoff before it gets to the waterways? Do you treat it? How do you manage it? What, talk to a bit about some developments there, or what maybe some more progressive cities or urban areas or even rural areas are doing in the US around stormwater. And where do you see stormwater going in terms of trends and around infrastructure? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I would say looking over the past kind of decade or so, there's been quite a lot of interest and development within the stormwater space overall. So the number of places that have set up specific utilities that are based on like a tax applied to a square footage of permeable space to set up for either storage or conveyance to another area, that has really grown quite a bit over the last decade. In terms of like specific municipalities that are trying to be more efficient with development, there are a number of more, I guess you could say, progressive cities that have fit in mandates for a certain amount of reuse or so forth for commercial developments over a certain size. So like Austin, Texas has put that into its sort of master planning and the way that they do developments. San Francisco is another, and New York City, these sort of more dense places that have certain water challenges are starting to incorporate the reuse and higher sort of mind share of water into all sort of their new developments, and then reuse that water for whether it's gray water and toilets or washing fleets of vehicles and DPW scenarios. But it's definitely seeping its way into the way that development is being conceived, both sort of a state and I'd say local level in certain areas.
In my own city where I live, they're going to be imposing that tax-based system based on the square footage. So it's an interesting approach, and it, you know, it kind of makes you think about when you're looking at your, you know, the land that you have, how to, you know, how much driveway or asphalt do you put in, where your cement's located. And so it definitely makes you think about it. Now, the other topic I wanted to jump in with you on is around sustainability and how municipalities think about sustainability, maybe around things like the materials that they're choosing, you know, in decision-making process. For example, does choosing a product with a lower carbon footprint matter to municipality? Are they even looking at that right now?
I think it depends. When talking about the pipe network, I'm thinking about what's happening out in the western part of the US. A lot of that development is more, say, like developer driven, and their largest concern is overall or upfront costs, and then they transfer it over to the municipality. So that is more kind of a cost driver. In certain areas that are, I'd say, more kind of water stressed, they're, I don't know if it gets so much in terms of like materials, but getting back to what I was mentioning about the way that development is approached to have more of a cyclical nature in terms of how water is thought of as a resource. Everything from like rain barrels that are being given incentives to invest in those, whether it's like a tax write-off or other sort of upfront incentives to using stormwater to supplement flows in areas that are very water stressed. It's thinking about the entire cyclical nature of water and how do we use different types of conveyances and gravity and so forth to maximize what's happening there. There's certain cities that have done a really good job, like Las Vegas. You'd think that being in the middle of the desert is a huge risk, but they've actually done a very good job in terms of reuse and the different ways that they, you know, source water, that it's more sustainable than some areas that you might think are a little bit more water rich. So there is a lot of opportunity to, I think, bolster that sort of sustainability stance. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of ways to come at it, right? It's not purely just picking a material or whatever, the different approaches based on the needs of the municipality. You mentioned, you know, water as a scarce resource. Do more and more people, do you think, understand that? You know, 20 years ago, probably, I don't think it was a top of mind concern. I think it's more a concern now, especially when, you know, if you live in certain places like California, you mentioned Nevada. Is that still a real important topic for us to think about in terms of water as a scarce resource?
Yeah, I think so. A lot obviously depends on where you live. And if you live obviously in like Southern California, you have no choice but to understand it in terms of kind of the mandates that'll be put on you. But one of the things that we do look at is some of these historical data around use per capita in certain regions. And, you know, you mentioned the Southwest there. Since 2005 or so, we've seen huge efficiency gains or drops per person in terms of what is used there. There is a behavioral element to it, right? Of don't leave the water on while you're brushing your teeth, or that sort of thing, that it takes a while to get into people's heads and they just make it normal. But there's been a lot of progress made, I think, in the really water stressed parts of the US anyway, to bring that per person use average down, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years. I think one of the things that we see now in terms of that public education moving onward is in the potable reuse sphere. So particularly, there's a couple of states that are now moving forward with direct potable reuse policies and standards. This would be not going through any type of specific environmental buffer, or they, as they call it, toilet to tap. And one of the biggest barriers to that is obviously just the perception of the public around that, of like, obviously it's not a great image to have in your mind of those words together. And there's a lot of just getting the public over the image of what that actually means. But you know,
you're talking about like reclaiming water from a home based on, you know, your everyday use, whether you're washing your dishes, your dishwasher, your toilet, shower. Talk to us a little bit about that, because you're right. I mean, it's not something that sounds understood. Like, how would that work? Is there technologies in place to recapture and clean the water? Is that how it's going to work?
Yeah. So, I mean, in this specific case, we're talking about like a wastewater treatment plant would have some pretty several steps of very kind of intensive treatment that would send it directly back to the drinking water plant without going into a reservoir or through any kind of like environmental buffer, which is typically referred to as indirect potable reuse. If you want to get really grand about it, everything is reuse, right? And it's the same water that's been here for eternity. But there is a mental block across a large portion of the public that thinks that, oh, this is water that I just flushed down my toilet 3 days ago, and it's just gone through a bunch of filters and disinfection, UV treatment, and now it's back at my tap. There is some public education initiatives in some of these areas that are experimenting with this that they say that's one of the biggest barriers. In terms of the treatment processes, they're pretty intensive. It's typically like reverse osmosis and then UV treatment and then different types of disinfection, could be like an advanced oxidation process, but multiple very expensive and intensive sort of treatment steps to get to whatever kind of the log treatment value is to meet the quality standards that the state has put out to do this on like a municipal scale. And in the last, I think it was Arizona that made some rules about this last year specifically. And I think California is doing it this year. It has been done, like it was done in Texas 10 years ago or so ago when they had a very severe drought, and then they rescinded that. So there were a couple of famous projects that were put in place for that. And then as they became less necessary, they moved away from it. But there are some states that are looking at their availability going forward, contingent on environmental and climatic effects, and realizing that it's something they need to be prepared for on a long-term basis. They're starting to put those specific policies together.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, this has been a great conversation, Greg. A lot of topics we covered. Appreciate your insights. Before we go, is there anything else you'd like to cover, or maybe you can reference how people can find you moving forward?
Sure. I guess just in terms of overall, we're sitting here talking about water, obviously, is a critical resource. And it's one of those things that, kind of to one of your last comments, Greg, like most of us here in the developed world, you turn the faucet and just expect it to be there. And typically it is. And people only really tend to think about it when that doesn't happen. And there are a lot of cases in recent history that have been pretty catastrophic. So you think about Flint, Michigan, Jackson, Mississippi. I think there was something pretty bad in Calgary recently, right? About like a large main break or something pretty catastrophic.
Yeah. And even not too far from here, Walkerton, we had several years ago, a very bad water contamination issue as well, E. coli.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like when things go wrong, they're usually pretty catastrophic. And so the emergency remediations or approaches to that are usually a lot more costly than preventive measures. As people are thinking about investments and on the policymaking spot, we're very underinvested in the U.S. and I think North America in general across this. So hopefully that's something that policymakers can kind of look at more holistically going forward. And then in terms of, we're at bluefieldresearch.com. We're always happy to connect with folks to discuss water challenges, whether you're within the vendor space or just trying to get educated within where investments and where policy is going. You could find us there. And yeah, we look forward to talking with folks.
Excellent. Thanks again, Greg.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Building Connections. You can find links to all of the resources mentioned in today's episode in the show notes. If you're finding value in our podcast, please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us connect with more listeners like you. Don't miss out on future episodes. Keep listening and building connections with us.